Take your seats, please. Be strong and courageous. Do not be frightened or dismayed, for the Lord your God is with you wherever you go. I have a thing for people who are strong and courageous. Maybe you do too. There's something about them that inspires me in my own courageous action and my own striving to be strong for the sake of others and for myself. Being with people who are strong and courageous, sharing friendship with them, is something for which I strive in my life. And it's something I've striven for my whole life. I met Jimmy Bartz a long time ago, like a quarter century ago, when I was a young man and he was a younger man. We were both serving in the Diocese of Texas. We were both involved in youth ministry. We were both looking for signs of God's actions in the periphery of what was going on in the world. When I met him at first, I suspected that he might be strong and courageous. My experience of him taught me and continues to teach me that he is, but his strength and his courage when I first met him wasn't the usual kind. He wasn't the kind of person that just kind of bowled me over. He wasn't like a superhero. He was flawed. He was imperfect. He was the sort of person that I really needed for a friend. You see, I used to believe that if I just had friends around me who were strong and courageous, then I wouldn't have to strive for those qualities quite so much. And that, of course, is a recipe for disaster. It's a way of being continually let down. It's because no single person can be strong and courageous all of the time. We may strive in this direction, but we can't keep it up all of the time. And of course, that's part of the good news. And it's taken me and it's taken Jimmy a long time to understand that it is our imperfections that make us beautiful. So, my dear friends, number one, do not expect Jimmy Bartz to be strong and courageous all of the time. That would be a disservice both to him and to your own good selves. Don't offload your desire for courage onto him. Don't project your need for strength onto him. Instead, do what I have been striving to do for almost a quarter century. Be his friend. Of course, being a friend is messy and dangerous, along with gorgeous and exhilarating. The kind of friendship that Jesus commands us to engage, what I like to call gospel friendship, is based on a kind of love that creates a permanent wound in your soul that is the source of both pain and life. Gospel friendship is more than just an idea. It's more than just a feeling. It's more than a top 10 list of do's and don'ts. Gospel friendship means surrendering a part of your will for the sake of the other person. It means surrendering a part of your desperate addiction to control to another person. Gospel friendship means that my story and my future are not all about me. There is much about the people I bind myself to in community. And of course, gospel friendship is about love. Most translations of John 15 include these words, "This is my commandment, love one another as I have loved you," which is a beautifully vague thing to say. A better translation of the verse makes clear that the commandment that Jesus gives isn't to love. The commandment results in love. So you might say, this is my commandment, so that you love one another as I have loved you. And you'll actually find the commandment of Jesus in another part of John's gospel in chapter 13. If I, your Lord and teacher, have washed your feet, you also ought to wash one another's feet. For I have set an example that you also should do as I have done to you. So in order to love one another, we must actively serve one another. Jesus commands his disciples and us to bow down to each other in humble service. It is in service that we learn how to love one another. It's in bowing down that we can take up love. And that's the definition of gospel friendship. Obedience to Jesus' commandment to serve requires your vulnerability. It requires your vulnerability to that wound that I mentioned a moment ago, the wound from which both, the wound that's made by love, the wound from which both life and pain come. Gospel friendship makes you vulnerable. It means opening yourself up to another person. And gospel friendship opens you up to the truth of yourself. It is in serving another and loving that person that your life actually increases. That's what it means to lay down your life for your friend. It means opening yourself to the love and the pain of being in a relationship to another. It means gaining new life by giving away your life. It means being transformed by our willingness to live in friendship. I think laying down our lives would be easy. Laying down our life for our friend would be easy if it only meant promising that you'd die for someone. I mean, it's like the parent who tells his son, I love you so much that if you were on a railroad track and I saw a train coming, I would like get you off the railroad track and take your place, which is an easy enough promise to make because really, how often is that likely to happen? So let's make this scenario really real and really hard. What about placing your beloved before your career? What about losing face before your coworkers for the sake of your beloved? What about naming your beloved's addiction to his face? What about changing your carefully made plans in life to make room for your beloved when she becomes physically challenged? I mean, and the list could go on and on and on. You get the point. Gospel friendship only matters when it takes place in real situations in real life, not unimaginable situations in an unimaginable life, because it's easy to fantasize about just being a martyr. The only way to get to the point where you can love so authentically is by continually practicing gospel friendship with each other. That's why you come here, week by week by week, so that you can go out there and live as friends with those you haven't even met yet. That's why gospel friendship must be the basis of the relationship that will make you the rector of this church. Because gospel friendship creates the capacity to love and to serve others. It brings the kind of vulnerability that makes each one of us real. And ultimately, it makes us more capable of knowing God. And here's the bad news in the middle of the good news. It means you've got to change. Now, I strive to be strong and courageous as a priest. And as I strive to be strong and courageous, I discover that I mess up my vocation of being a priest. Because there are times, Jimmy, when I forget that the rector's job is not just guiding the ship around the hidden shoals that threaten to wreck it. Usually I mess up my vocation because I forget the small things that I'm supposed to do. Not things that I'm supposed to do as a priest or a rector, but things that I'm supposed to do as a human being and as a follower of Jesus Christ. I find that when I mess up things, maybe you do the same, it's usually because I forget that the small actions in my life take up more of my life than the big things do. I think small actions are in part what Paul is writing about in the Epistle to the Romans, where he says, let love be genuine, hate what is evil, hold fast to what is good, love one another with mutual affection, outdo one another in showing honor, do not lag in zeal, be ardent in spirit, serve the Lord, rejoice in hope, be patient in suffering, persevere in prayer, contribute to the needs of the saints, extend hospitality to strangers. Paul is like rattling off this list of things to do. And notice that these are small, specific actions. Maybe they're not easy things to accomplish, but they're just functional tasks. Love. Hold to the good, show honor to one another, serve, rejoice, give, be hospitable. And notice that all of these things are based in friendship. These are things that we do together in community, looking at one another. Here's a, preachers always do this. Preachers always give you the background in the Bible, so get ready for it. Paul's letter to the Romans was probably written to a house church of about 30 members. These are the first person that heard the word spoken. Of those 30 people, there's a scholar that I read that says it's a good bet that a half a dozen of them were slaves. And it's an equally good bet that among those slaves, probably one member of the house church was the owner of another member of the house church. Think about that. So when Paul says, outdo one another in showing honor, it was an instruction to slave owners to show honor to those whom everyone else knew to be their property. And nobody would bat an eye if a slave girl would open the door for her master or mistress, but if the master or mistress were to open the door for the slave girl, that would raise eyebrows. And more than that, it would have been a fundamental challenge to the structures of the household, which is only a few steps removed from the challenge that was given to the people in the Roman church by the structures of the entire empire. So please do notice this when you make church together. Paul is undermining boundaries. And he's kicking apart the most enduring social institutions for the sake of the gospel. Slaves rise to the same level as masters. Women and men and children are all the same. Foreigners, Jews, Gentiles. They're all the same humanity. The only authority that Paul acknowledges, the authority that claims each person as honorable and loved, is God's. It's on the basis of God's authority that we, the members of the church, can dare to change the world. And that's where you all come in. That's why you came tonight, to find out what your job description is going to be. Dear people of St. John's, you are authorized by God to be the church. Committed to you is nothing less than the mission of God in the world. You have the authority that God shares with us to build the kingdom. And that authority is balanced with the wisdom of Paul's instruction, live in harmony with one another. Do not be haughty, but associate with the lowly. Do not claim to be wiser than you are. And likewise, don't claim to be stupid when you know you're wise. Which is to say that authority and humility have to go hand in hand. You can't exercise one without the other. And Jimmy, as the rector of St. John's, you get to do the same thing. You get to use your authority with humility and your humility with authority. You get to stand with the marginalized people of our world and become what you could never be if the world owned your soul. As this congregation's rector, you get to be a dangerously subversive player in the world, just like St. Paul. You get to lead your people in the ongoing work of asking dangerous questions about every dominant and dehumanizing structure of our culture, and then working with them to bring them all down. And both authority and humility will be at the heart of what it means to become the rector here. They're practices that have the power to lead you through the changes and chances of what it will mean to become the rector of St. John's. And they will lead you to find new ways of taking on the new humanity of Christ. It's only when you embrace authority and humility that you'll quit playing at being the rector and truly become the rector that your people need you to be. That they need you to be for their soul's health. And that's when your strength and your courage can begin to make a difference in the world. And when, you know, you find you lose your courage and your strength, which you absolutely will, then call on these people to lift you up. My dear people of St. John's, you will be blessed in being the church. And you will be a blessing to one another. And Jimmy will help you to do that. So take risks. Look to the one who calls you, first of all, who is our Savior Jesus Christ. And remember that this is a new day, but it's not the last day. There is work to do, and you will do it in 1,000 little ways every day. You will walk the pathway of God's friendship with Jimmy as your rector. Amen.